Okay, I know it's hard to stop fellowshipping, but we want to give Steve all the time that he's due. It's so interesting, and it's so uplifting at this time of tension and really ugly discourse in our politics. It's so uplifting to hear what could be. That's what I feel. Okay, I want to thank the White Group for food today. Thank you very much. I want to remind you that next week it's the Pink Group who are bringing food. And we have Father Jim Clark coming next week. And he's going to be doing a summary of the book and a time of reconciliation, which will be really important next Thursday. Yeah, after the election. So hope we see everybody next week.
I think it's easier to speak after the Cubs win the World Series than to speak after the election, that's for sure. Okay, so we'll resume, and I think one section on technology and stuff, maybe we'll put that aside for another time, I think, in order to honor the book and work through the material in a reasonable pace. So author goes then to Republicans, enlightened Republicans, and here's the list of things that he, if he could write a request list to the Republican Party and supporters, that it'd be progress-oriented conservatism, and by that I think he means, you know, future-oriented, not going back. Entrepreneurial, but with checks and balances, kind of a blend. And I think the author himself and some of his colleagues in Silicon Valley and everything else understand the power of entrepreneurship. And Lee just told me a story at the break, and I'll summarize it, try to summarize it real quickly. But you were in South Africa right after apartheid ended, and you wanted to get a new flag. And they didn't know where you could get one. But then they took you to like a little area, and some guy out of the back of his van was selling these, on a clothesline, was selling the new African flags, and you looked and it said Made in Taiwan, right? But what was beautiful, what you were saying about that, is that the entrepreneurial spirit. Some guy, all he had was a van. He figured out how to have some company in Taiwan make these new African flags, had them shipped to himself before maybe the stores weren't stocking them, and he was there ready to sell them. And that's a beautiful thing. And I remember, I know so little about Africa, but I remember coming and landing in Accra and going into Ghana, and there were people selling stuff all over the place. And if you're trying to sell things, you're an entrepreneur. You know? So it's not as if, and I think, well, anyway, I'll stop there. So anyway, just wanted to honor Lee's story of that entrepreneurial. But we know in American history there's been the need for checks and balances. The most famous, of course, with Theodore Roosevelt, and then again with FDR. It's a tricky one, right? Because the sense is too much regulation, and certainly in the nonprofit world, and a director of a nonprofit, with labor issues and HR stuff, wow, it is so complicated. If it's time to let somebody go, it is really, really complicated. And whenever we hear of new legislation, often I support the spirit of it, but Stephanie and I just go, okay, what's that going to mean for us, you know? So I can understand both sides. I think we need regulation for justice and equity, but then sometimes we also need to have entrepreneurial spirit. Interdisciplined. It's kind of interesting. I feel my role today is not to be partisan or personal, but to kind of be an observer of American culture and history, because I love America. Interdiscipline. I think the Republican Party's had a lot of history of interdiscipline, you know, of restraint. George H.W. Bush had a lot of restraint. And people like Bob Dole, Jerry Ford back in his time, there was a real willingness to work with other sides, to kind of see oneself as not the answer to everything. Green. I think everybody's got to be green. Global. I think it's interesting. And again, I want to be nonpartisan, but comparing George, well, I really didn't mean it. Comparing George H.W. Bush and his son, George W., George H.W. Bush had been in the Navy, right, in the Pacific. He'd experienced other cultures. He was ambassador to China for quite a bit of time. He had lived in other parts of the world. He had seen the world from other eyes. And he came from a family history in the Bush family in New England where you were self-effacing and you didn't show off or use power. And I think for George W., apparently he had not spent much time in other countries. He never really lived outside of America. And I think for people, I mean, George H.W. is a good example of Peace Corps and church missionaries around the world or international education exchange. It seemed to temper his view of the world. And that first Iraq War, he had, what, 100 and some allies with him? Because he could understand that. And I think his son didn't have that same breadth of experience. And I'm going to do a little bit of a connection here. Some of you might have heard David Gergen speak last spring, I think. I can't remember when it was. But David Gergen, who has served President Nixon, I think President Reagan, Clinton, one of the Bushes, I think. I mean, he's one of these rare people that have served Democrats and Republicans. And he was thinking about the divide, and he had this idea that he looked back and he saw the leaders from the 50s and 60s and 70s in America had all had been, one thing they had in common is they'd been through World War II together, and they'd been in the military together, and that, as Gergen was saying, that being in the military, especially when there was the draft, there was a mix of social classes, states that people were from, different levels of education, different racial groups. But the military taught them that you have to come together to achieve a goal. And I know my dad talked about, after World War II, the people in his unit from Arkansas and some of the funny stories about them. But they were side by side working together to achieve a common goal. And Gergen said, so that whole generation that had experienced that when it came down to brass tacks, they knew that sometimes how and the importance of coming together. But he said, since the end of the draft, and with no national service, people can grow up in vastly different worlds and are never really brought together to work for a common goal, and especially with the segmentation of media, if this group is all just listening to its own media and websites and everything, and this group, same, but they never mix, then no wonder it's difficult to communicate. I thought that was an interesting point from Gergen, and I think Gergen's one of those people who really advocates for some kind of national service that everybody should, either in the military or in peaceful means, that kind of a thing. And I think that's an American concept, that we all come together, and we may go back and our paths lead different ways, but we're stronger when we know how to work together. Okay, so pro-liberties do not legislate morality. Wisdom seeker, open to science, humorous. I guess the Democrats need to be fun and the Republicans need to be humorous. So I guess the Republicans have to tell jokes and the Democrats laugh at them. I don't know what. But relates well to the left. And I think, as Gergen and others talk about, and it's well known, back in the day, Reagan and Tip O'Neill would always be at each other, and at night, Gergen would come over to the White... I mean, O'Neill would come over to the White House, they'd have a little whiskey, and they'd work out the legislation, smiling with each other, and go back the next day and announce they'd got a deal, you know? And that wasn't shameful. That was politics. And they had their constituencies, but they could come together for a higher purpose. And I think in all this, I was intrigued by John Kasich when Kasich was running, and early on when the topic of Obamacare came up. And Kasich, governor of Ohio, and he's one of the states that had accepted Obamacare, he got in trouble because he said, I think healthcare is a Christian thing. So I think as a Republican candidate that lasted quite a while, I was really impressed that he could give respect to, and regardless of the challenges of healthcare, that he could do that. And I think a lot of Republicans in the past had been able to do that. Any comments from all of you about the list for Republicans either for things that would help. Yes?
Use the microphone.
If it's a short question, I can repeat it. If it's... Right, like a lot of countries in Europe have a year of service of some kind. Yeah, the Mormons? Yeah, somebody mentioned that. Absolutely. I know as a pastor, we started doing youth group trips across the border and worked with a wonderful organization called the Mormon Ministries. And it wasn't like Habitat, but we would take 15 to 20 young people down, and you could build a house in 4 days. The first day you pour the slab, the next day you do the framing and frame the roof, and the next day you start working on the stucco and actual roofing, and then the last day is a few windows. And it had a transformative effect for those kids. Because not only their hands, which had usually been on devices, suddenly, and there was no power tools, so he had to use a real saw, real hammer, you know, and they were just in awe of what they physically and mentally, they could build a house for somebody and work as a team. And I remember one guy, one of the adult advisors, as we crossed the border, let on that he was not too pleased with having to go down into Mexico. And on the way back, he said, "That really changed me. Now I understand why they'd want to come to America, and I have such respect for anybody who wants to try, and I can't wait to go on the next trip." You know? And I think, well, I think everybody agrees on that here, but I mean, that seeing the world through other people's eyes changes us. And the five-year-old simplistic mind doesn't work as well when we've experienced things from different perspectives. Anything else on enlightened Republicans? Oh, yes, yes, uh-huh.
I went to a function that was put on by the United Nations last week, and there was a young man there who was a high schooler, and part of the we were all in committees, and then he went up and spoke about this group, and his suggestion was he did service when he was in high school, and he thought that adults should do that too, that it should be continued on past high school.
Uh-huh. Not just high school, but into adulthood. Yes.
I think in this time of such polarization, it's really hard to have a conversation with those that don't agree with us. And I was really enthused watching the show Hamilton. It was on a couple of weeks ago. It was on Friday night and again Saturday. So I watched it twice. And I think if we recall the gift that the founding fathers gave mm-hmm. us of this wonderful democracy and just treasure that, it will help our thinking and our ability to converse with each other.
Because they worked through deep differences, absolutely, that continued for their whole life, right? And the Federalist Papers, these letters going back and forth about not agreeing on things, but there is a belief that you should engage in that. Yes, Barbara.
The same event that Judy is talking about, the overall consensus of everybody there, 85 people said it was the conversation after the film that unified us, that brought us together, that made us realize that conversation is the solution for so many problems.
Uh-huh.
So I just wanted to share that.
Did everybody hear that? The conversation after the film was really valuable. People said that's when they really came together. So Barbara's saying that not only seeing something, but then having or being part of something, but then engaging and yeah, that's great. Okay, break. We're going to not talk about the limits of progress. We're going to do that maybe another time. But let's go to fulfillment of America's spiritual mission. He says, this was a Mohawk prayer that he quotes at the beginning of the chapter. Put your politics in one hand and spirit in the other, and then fold them together. When I was at hospice, I did some training, Zen Hospice Center up in Marin County. And if you're familiar, if you've ever been to a yoga class at the Y or any place else, or any place, there's a common thing when you're done of a namaste. It's a traditional Asian blessing. And the teacher, the Zen teacher, was saying, I'm not sure if this is literally true, but I love the image. He said, what it means is you have compassion in one hand and wisdom in the other, and you bring them together. Because sometimes we can feel compassion, and it may cause us to do things that we turn out later wasn't so wise. You know, we have bringing three kittens home or something when we're kids. Oh, look at the cute little kiss. But then as an adult, you're saying, how can we care for that? We can be wise, but without compassion, we're kind of detached. And I think especially, I mean, I use that at hospice and, you know, when I do nonprofit work, that we're in nonprofit work because we have compassion. But we have to be thoughtful about it, too, because we have to think about our resources and we have to make decisions we have to deal with complexity. So we don't want to lose the compassion, but we also got to bring along the wisdom, you know, the intelligence to do things right so it's not just an emotional reaction. He said, kind of just like the comment just made, founding documents emerged like holy texts guided from above but still written by the hands of men. Which is almost a perfect quote from I'm sure it's not a quote, but it's exactly the 1967 Presbyterian Statement on Interpretation of Scripture, is that these are inspired words, but nevertheless, they came through human beings, and they must be interpreted with cultural understanding. And I think, I think about those documents, how stirring they still are. When I was in D.C. for that trip, I go down to the Supreme Court building and to see where the Supreme Court was for decades, the small little room where these people gathered around a table and made these decisions. And I think a lot about when I was in my interfaith work, there was a Muslim guy here, Hussam Musa. Some of you may have met Hussam. But he had grown up in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, came to America, was a PhD student at UCSB, now works in the Bay Area. But he would tell me, he said, do you know how beautiful the Constitution is? He says, you know, from Egypt, we have pieces of paper, but nobody reads them, that they look good. But America is a place that really tries to struggle with this. And he eventually became a citizen, and I would always look to him to tell me about the Constitution because he had such an appreciation for it. And it's extraordinary that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, in that 10-year period or so in the 18th century is something now that still, even if we debate about it and Supreme Court nominees, still has incredible power to keep us together and in checks and balances. I mean, it really is extraordinary. Okay, so I think that's a great point. And he says, all of our most heartfelt and cherished dreams are also infused with sacred meaning. I think that's true for all countries as well. I think certainly at its best, I think the American dream has that God and country is a very powerful concept, you know, and at our best, those things are well aligned. It's interesting about Abraham Lincoln. There's a great book on his second address, his inaugural address by Ron White, where he really does a close analysis of that speech. And one of the things he talks about is that Lincoln was obviously a brilliant, inquisitive mind. And in those days, you were supposed to join a church. You would pay each year for the pew that you were going to be sitting in. It was kind of a way of contributing to the church. So there was pressure wherever Lincoln was to join a church and buy a pew. But he quietly said that he didn't really want to join a church because he didn't trust clergy people who thought they knew the mind of God. But in the early 1860s, in the middle of the Civil War, there was one Presbyterian pastor, I think it was Fourth Presbyterian Church in D.C., that would do a weeknight Bible study. And what that pastor wrestled with a lot was the question of providence. How do we figure out what God's will is? And Lincoln heard about him and made arrangements that when this guy was teaching, Lincoln didn't want to show up at the Bible study. That kind of disrupts the Bible study when the president joins your Bible study. But he made arrangements that the pastor's study library, would he could access it from a back door, and the door was open, he could listen in. on this pastor struggling with scripture and issues of providence as he was trying to figure out the Civil War. And in that second inaugural, it's just saturated with biblical concepts. But it's not just a tossing off a quote, or it's really getting complicated and thinking it through in just a very few words. So that sense about sacred meaning, I think Lincoln was both a skeptic and a person of deep faith, and a marvelous contribution to what it is to be an American. He says, the deepest truth is that America has always been sacred, as have all other countries, cultures, and peoples of the world. There is nothing that is not sacred, nothing that is not woven with the threads of the divine. When the Barry said there's no such thing as sacred and secular, there's only sacred and desacralized. That everything starts sacred, and we can mess it up, though. We can damage that sacred nature, but that's us, not the sacred nature itself. And then he says, "This is how about this for the next, until Tuesday's election? We can relax into a deep recognition of our oneness with all the peoples of the earth and live out a higher vision." And that may be something worth trying in the days and weeks ahead, to try one time a day to kind of relax into a deeper vision. Because right now it feels fragmented. It feels sometimes hopeless. There's so much intensity. So I want to kind of come to close here with this theme, which I think of many tribes, many nations, one world. There's a real power in tribes. Because tribes give us identity and dignity, sports and politics, say. So if you're a Cub fan, you've been suffering a long time, your tribe, and now your tribe is obviously celebrating the passion. Any of you saw the news clips from outside Wrigley Field last night or whatever? Just exultation about this. It's just a game, you know. But the power of that within us. And at La Casa, about a month ago, there was a group here from different parts of the country, and there was a woman, I started talking with her, she's from Akron, Ohio. We talked a little bit about baseball. I usually try to talk about baseball with guests. But she did say that this year, as you may know, the Cleveland Cavaliers won the first NBA championship in the history of Cleveland. And she said what was amazing was the city, who has had such tough times, crime and violence and poverty, that there was an incredible sense of unanimity across the whole city. Crime almost disappeared. People of all social classes were greeting each other like family. Sports is a complicated thing. But I remember when I was working in Philadelphia, inner city Philadelphia, and everybody across social classes would be following the Phillies or the Flyers or the Sixers. And there was a common thing. When I was in rural Washington, there was no common informal sports team. And so there was kind of this disconnection. Not everybody has to be a sports fan. But what I'm saying is there's a sense of, there's power in belonging to tribes in sports and politics. But as we know, I think in America, there's a lot of sense right now that there's a disaffected tribe out there. And often as we read about it, it's a lot of white males, less education in areas that they feel economically abandoned, that there's not much hope. And in some of those areas, there's not much hope. And there is a change going on. I've been listening book on tape to Hillbilly Elegy. Maybe some of you have read that or know it. It's quite popular right now. And it reminds me some of growing up in that rural area where there were, to use the word from the book, rednecks, you know. But some of these rednecks would be the people that would drop bags of fruit when it was the top of the season by my doorstep, would bring food when my wife was in the hospital, their family would bring food for us, you know. There's no five-year-old advantage in using the five-year-old mind to oversimplify. But I think there is this change going on in America, and it's a deep one. And the election is opening it up, and certainly something ahead of us is how do we heal and go on for that greater vision. In that light, About a year ago, Steve Cohen, a rabbi at B'nai B'rith, and terrific guy and a valued friend, he was celebrating 30 years between Hillel and Isla Vista and B'nai B'rith, and they had a deal at the Bakara for him, to honor him. 500 people came to the Bakara to honor Steve. And he got up and gave a really beautiful talk. It was fairly brief. And he was saying, what's his vision as a rabbi here at Congregation B'nai B'rith? What's his vision for what he wants to see happen, the effect of his work as a rabbi and their congregation? And he said, one part of his vision is that he wants their young people to unconsciously say for the rest of their life, we Jews. So we Jews observe Yom Kippur. We Jews believe we have an obligation to help the poor. We Jews respect the Torah. To be very clear on their Jewish identity. Then he said, but we also want them to say, just as unconsciously, we Americans. And as part of their confirmation process at the temple, they take kids and they take them to Washington, D.C. and spend a week there meeting with congressional representatives and saying, you're Jewish and you're American. And you really need to appreciate what America means to us and what its potential is. And he said, there's one more thing that we want them to be able to say without thinking is that we citizens of the planet, of the earth as a whole. And they teach that, those three things. And I was very moved by that. The importance of having a tribe, I mean, as a congregational pastor, I knew the importance of having connection when there's a tragedy that strikes and a congregation comes around instantly. So often in our culture now, people live without those connections, and especially when tragedy happens, there's some few attempts, people mean well, but there's no structure to hold you. There's no tribe to come and pick you up and hold you when things are falling apart. Tribes are really powerful that way, and congregations are powerful that way. But also, we're Americans, and America respects that identity, that religious identity, but also to be part of that whole. But certainly in the last 50 years, we've had to even more think that and that, but also the whole global connection because of the way globalization has worked and because of everything from climate change to nuclear weapons. We can no longer think small, we have to think big. So, getting back to where we were at the Statue of Liberty. 1974, I'd been in Europe for 5 months and was coming back. And I flew into Kennedy Airport and I came down off the airplane. And there were three baggage handlers there. Three guys from different ethnic groups, you could tell, different racial ethnic groups. And they were arguing. And they were arguing about the Mets. And I thought, I'm home. People are, you know, taking the sports thing again, but there's this, oh, come on, you don't know what you're talking. But there was this sense that they have a shared concern with differences. And they were friends, and they worked together with the differences. And they kind of enjoyed those differences. When I was a pastor in Washington, rural Washington, there was a number of Filipino families, a whole series of connected Filipino families that were part of my congregation. And they'd all come over. The father had come over first from the Philippines, and then eight kids came over at different times and became teachers and independent business people. And one year, they invited us to come to their 4th of July out of this park. We were the only non-Filipinos there. And there's a tradition in Filipino culture of oratory. And they took turns talking about what America had meant to them, about how the lack of opportunity in their own country and each of their stories. They were just, this is a family thing. We just happened to be the side guests, but about this real appreciation for one dear friend who's godmother to one of our kids. She talked about, you know, how she was a teacher in the Philippines but had very, very little hope. She came here and she was met with some discrimination. Somebody, a teacher for a credential program said, with your accent, you're never going to be a good teacher. But she became a master teacher. And she talked about, in America, you can have that vision and achieve that. And I felt, to this day, that's my favorite 4th of July I've ever had, is to hear this family talk about what it meant for them. And then in May of 1999, our first daughter was graduated from college, and luckily, because we had no money, we were able to get a scholarship for her to go to Vassar, because we couldn't afford it, pay for it. And we went back for her graduation, and we actually stayed at a little apartment in Dobbs Ferry that Barbara and her husband had allowed us to stay in, which was just 45 minutes up from Manhattan, more or less. Well, so I took my two younger daughters down to Ellis Island. My grandmother had come over about 1819 from Sweden by herself. She had a pneumonia of some kind, so she was quarantined for a while. She came to America, came to Redlands, had to take 2 years to work off her passage as a maid in the house of this guy in Riverside. And I never met her because she had a lot of depression in her life and committed suicide before I was born. But she'd given birth to two daughters. One of them was my mom. My mama had some tough stuff happen to her, but I was her grandson, this immigrant's grandson, and I was going to Ellis Island. If you've been to Ellis Island, it's wonderful. When you come into the area, without any fanfare, there's all these suitcases and luggage from all over the world, different kinds of suitcases that people actually brought from all over the world to come to America. And they have the benches where people would snake through as they were waiting to be examined. And a couple of them had been restored from 1900 on. So we sat in one of those benches, my two daughters and I, and we looked up the Hudson River at the Statue of Liberty. And my grandmother came over here, and it didn't really work well for her. She was depressed, and she took her own life. But her great-granddaughter is graduating up that Hudson River from a college that would have been unimaginable to my grandmother even going to college, let alone going to one of these kind of colleges. And I felt like, I'm sorry what happened to her, but I'm glad she made the passage. You know, because the opportunity that I've had and my kids have had.
I think we all have those stories.
Yeah.
What would we do without walking on being on the shoulders of our ancestors?
Absolutely.
We all have those stories.
And I think what we have now of people wanting to come to America who are going to be ancestors for new generations, right?
That's right.
And I think that's the vision. So, you know, it's complicated. And that little boy in the movie, but that little boy and all those immigrants on that boat probably didn't speak English, didn't know what was going to happen. But there was a promise out there, you know, that drew them from all the places they were. I was preaching one time around the 4th of July, and I thought, you know, it's as simple as this. America's not an ethnic group. It's a dream. And sometimes America, frankly, gets confused as a white country. It was written, these great documents were written by white men, remarkable documents. But the vision that lifts up is not, at the time, maybe they couldn't conceive that women would ever vote, let alone other people. But what's lived out is that it's a dream. It's the sacred, sacred dream. So, what I'd like to do is close, and then with a song. And I can't sing worth a darn. But it's a song that the tune is familiar. It's called This Is My Song. Some of you may know it. It's a wonderful song. But on the break, I typed out the lyrics because I forgot to bring them. So can everybody read that pretty much? Okay, so if you want to play the melody.
Stand up.
Okay, stand up if you would. This is my song, O God of all the nations, a song of peace for lands afar and mine. This is my home, the country. Mother homes in other lands.
skies are everywhere as blue as mine. Oh, hear my song, thou God of all the nations, the song of peace for their land and for mine.
And Cracker Jack.
I don't care if I never get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, for it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
All right. So we can stick around and discuss if you want. If people need to go, they can.
Okay, I think we should...
Somebody's going to lose, but we're still all together.
That's right.
I think that last song was so appropriate.
Absolutely right.
Okay, well, we want to thank Steve Jacobson, and I think it's time we should also sing Happy Birthday to Steve.
Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday dear Steve, happy birthday to you.
Well, you're a wonderful tribe, and I'm glad to be an honorary member of your tribe.
Thank you. Keep going.
I was just
going
to say, if people want to stick around and talk, we can. If people need to go, no problem.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Gail. Yes. The music helps. Two things that unite us are baseball and music. And now Judith has one more announcement.
I just want to mention that the Liberty Bell Minute that you've been getting information for about on your emails at 6 o'clock every evening. If we collectively think good thoughts about coming up election, that common sense reigns, and that we have a sacred America. 6 o'clock every night.